restlessly, gazing at all the church and chapel going, as at a thing with which they had no manner of concern. Nor was it merely the stranger who noticed this, because there was a native organization in Coketown itself, whose members were to be heard of in the House of Commons every session, indignantly petitioning for acts of Parliament that should make these people religious by main force. Then came the Teetotal Society, who complained that these same people would get drunk, and showed in tabular statements that they did get drunk, and proved at tea parties that no inducement human or divine, except a medal, would induce them to forego their custom of getting drunk. Then came the chemist and druggist with other tabular statements, showing that when they didn't get drunk, they took opium. Then came the experienced chaplain of the jail with more tabular statements, outdoing all the previous tabular statements, and showing that the same people would resort to low haunts hidden from the public eye, where they heard low singing and saw low dancing, and mayhap joined in it, and where A.B., aged 24 next birthday and committed for 18 months solitary, had himself said, not that he had ever shown himself particularly worthy of belief, his ruin began, as he was perfectly sure and confident that otherwise he would have been a tip-top moral specimen. Then came Mr. Gradgrind and Mr. Bounderby, the two gentlemen at this present moment walking through Coketown, and both eminently practical, who could on occasion furnish more tabular statements derived from their own personal experience and illustrated by cases they had known and seen, from which it clearly appeared, in short, it was the only clear thing in the case, that these same people were a bad lot altogether, gentlemen. That do what you would for them, they were never thankful for it, gentlemen. That they were restless gentlemen, that they never knew what they wanted, that they lived upon the best and bought fresh butter, and insisted on mocha coffee, and rejected all but prime parts of meat, and yet were eternally dissatisfied and unmanageable. In short, it was the moral of the old nursery fable. There was an old woman, and what do you think? She lived upon nothing but victuals and drink. Victuals and drink were the whole of her diet, and yet this old woman would never be quiet. Is it possible, I wonder, that there was any analogy between the case of the Coketown population and the case of the little Gradgrinds? Surely none of us in our sober senses and acquainted with figures are to be told at this time of day that one of the foremost elements in the existence of the Coketown working people had been for scores of years deliberately set at naught? That there was any fancy in them demanding to be brought into healthy existence instead of struggling on in convulsions? That exactly in the ratio as they worked, long and monotonously, the craving grew within them for some physical relief, some relaxation, encouraging good humour and good spirits, and giving them a vent, some recognised holiday, though it were but for an honest dance to a stirring band of music, some occasional light pie in which even Machocom child had no finger, which craving must and would be satisfied aright, or must and would inevitably go wrong, until the laws of the creation were repealed. "This man lives at Pod's End, and I don't quite know Pod's End," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Which is it, Bounderby?" Mr. Bounderby knew it was somewhere downtown, but knew no more respecting it, so they stopped for a moment, looking about. Almost as they did so, there came running around the corner of the street at a quick pace and with a frightened look, a girl whom Mr. Gradgrind recognized. "Hello," said he. "Stop! Where are you going? Stop!" Girl number 20 stopped then, palpitating, and made him a curtsy. "Why are you tearing about the streets," said Mr. Gradgrind, "in this improper manner?" "I was run after, sir," the girl panted, "and I wanted to get away."
"Run after?" repeated Mr. Gradgrind. "Who would run after you?"
The question was unexpectedly and suddenly answered for her by the colourless boy Bitzer, who came round the corner with such blind speed and so little anticipating a stoppage on the pavement that he brought himself up against Mr. Gradgrind's waistcoat and rebounded into the road.
"What do you mean, boy?" said Mr. Gradgrind. "What are you doing? How dare you dash against everybody in this manner?"
Bitzer picked up his cap, which the concussion had knocked off, and backing and knuckling his forehead, pleaded that it was an accident.
"Was this boy running after you, Jupe?"
asked Mr. Gradgrind. "Yes, sir," said the girl reluctantly.
"No, I wasn't, sir," cried Bitzer. "Not till she ran away from me. But the horse riders never mind what they say, sir. They're famous for it. You know, the horse riders are famous for never minding what they say," addressing Sissy. "It's as well known in the town as, please, sir, as the multiplication table isn't known to the horse riders."
Bitzer tried Mr. Bounderby with this.
"He frightened me so," said the girl, "with his cruel faces."
"Oh," cried Bitzer, "oh, ain't you one of the rest? Ain't you a horse rider? I never looked at her, sir. I asked her if she would know how to define a horse tomorrow, and offered to tell her again, and she ran away, and I ran after her, sir, that she might know how to answer when she was asked. You wouldn't thought of saying such mischief if you hadn't been a horse rider."
"Her calling seems to be pretty well known among them," observed Mr. Bounderby. "You'd have the whole school peeping in a row in a week."
"Truly, I think so," returned his friend. "Bitzer, turn you about and take yourself home. Jupe, stay here a moment. Let me hear of your running in this manner any more, boy, and you will hear of me through the master of the school. You understand what I mean? Go along." The boy stopped in his rapid blinking, knuckled his forehead again, glanced at Sissy, turned about, and retreated.
"Now, girl," said Mr. Gradgrind, "take this gentleman and me to your father's. We are going there. What have you got in that bottle you are carrying?"
"Gin," said Mr. Bounderby.
"Dear no, sir, it's the nine oils."
"The what?" cried Mr. Bounderby.
"The nine oils, sir, to rub father with."
"Then," said Mr. Bounderby with a loud, short laugh, "what the devil do you rub your father with nine oils for?"
"It's what our people always use, sir, when they get any hurts in the ring," replied the girl, looking over her shoulder to assure herself that her pursuer was gone. "They bruise themselves very bad sometimes."
"Serve 'em right," said Mr. Bounderby, "for being idle."
She glanced up at his face with mingled astonishment and dread.
"By George," said Mr. Bounderby, "when I was 4 or 5 years younger than you, I had worse bruises upon me than 10 oils, 20 oils, 40 oils would have rubbed off. I didn't get 'em by posture-making, but by being banged about. There was no rope dancing for me. I danced on the bare ground and was larruped with the rope."
Mr. Gradgrind, though hard enough, was by no means so rough a man as Mr. Bounderby. His character was not unkind, all things considered. It might have been a very kind one indeed, if he had only made some round mistake in the arithmetic that balanced it years ago. He said, in what he meant for a reassuring tone, as they turned down a narrow road,
"And this is Pod's End, is it, Jupe?"
"This is it, sir, and if you wouldn't mind, sir, this is the house."
She stopped, at twilight, at the door of a mean little public house with dim red lights in it, as haggard and as shabby as if, for want of custom, it had itself taken to drinking, and had gone the way all drunkards go, and was very near the end of it.
"It's only crossing the bar, sir, and up the stairs, if you wouldn't mind, and waiting there for a moment till I get the candle. If you should hear a dog, sir, it's only Merrylegs, and he only barks."
"Merrylegs and nine oils, eh?" said Mr. Bounderby, entering last with his metallic laugh. "Pretty well this for a self-made man."
Chapter 6. Sleary's Horsemanship. The name of the public house was the Pegasus Arms. The Pegasus Legs might have been more to the purpose, but underneath the winged horse upon the signboard, the Pegasus Arms was inscribed in Roman letters. Beneath that inscription again, in a flowing scroll, the painter had touched off the lines, "Good malt makes good beer. Walk in and they'll draw it here. Good wine makes good brandy. Give us a call and you'll find it handy." Framed and glazed upon the wall behind the dingy little bar was another Pegasus, a theatrical one, with real gauze let in for his wings, golden stars stuck on all over him, and his ethereal harness made of red silk. As it had grown too dusky without to see the sign, and as it had not grown light enough within to see the picture, Mr. Gradgrind and Mr. Bounderby received no offence from these idealities. They followed the girl up some steep corner stairs without meeting anyone, and stopped in the dark while she went on for a candle.
They expected every moment to hear Merrylegs give tongue, but the highly trained performing dog had not barked when the girl and the candle appeared together.
"Father is not in our room, sir," she said, with a face of great surprise. "If you wouldn't mind walking in, I'll find him directly."
They walked in, and Sissy, having set two chairs for them, sped away with a quick, light step. It was a mean, shabbily furnished room, with a bed in it. The white nightcap embellished with two peacock's feathers and a pigtail bolt upright, in which Senior Jupe had that very afternoon enlivened the varied performances with his chaste Shakespearean quips and retorts, hung upon a nail. But no other portion of his wardrobe, or other token of himself or his pursuits, was to be seen anywhere. As to Merrylegs, that respectable ancestor of the highly trained animal who went aboard the Ark might have been accidentally shut out of it for any sign of a dog that was manifest to eye or ear in the Pegasus arms. They heard the doors of rooms above opening and shutting as Sissy went from one to another in quest of her father, and presently they heard voices expressing surprise. She came bounding down again in a great hurry, opened a battered and mangy old hair trunk, found it empty, and looked round with her hands clasped and her face full of terror.
"Father must have gone down to the booth, sir. I don't know why he should go there, but he must be there. I'll bring him in a minute."
She was gone directly, without her bonnet, with her long, dark, childish hair streaming behind her.
"What does she mean?" said Mr. Gradgrind. "Back in a minute. It's more than a mile off."
Before Mr. Bounderby could reply, a young man appeared at the door, and introducing himself with the words, "By your laves, gentlemen," walked in with his hands in his pockets. His face, close-shaven, thin and sallow, was shaded by a great quantity of dark hair brushed into a roll all round his head and parted up the centre. His legs were very robust, but shorter than legs of good proportions should have been. His chest and back were as much too broad as his legs were too short. He was dressed in a Newmarket coat and tight-fitting trousers, wore a shawl round his neck, smelt of lamp oil, straw, orange peel, horse's provender and sawdust, and looked a most remarkable sort of centaur, compounded of the stable and the playhouse. Where the one began and the other ended, nobody could have told with any precision. This gentleman was mentioned in the bills of the day as Mr. E. W. B. Childers, so justly celebrated for his daring vaulting act as the wild huntsman of the North American prairies, in which popular performance a diminutive boy with an old face who now accompanied him assisted as his infant son, being carried upside down over his father's shoulder by one foot and held by the crown of his head, heels upwards, in the palm of his father's hand, according to the violent paternal manner in which wild huntsmen may be observed to fondle their offspring. Made up with curls, wreaths, wings, white bismuth and carmine, this hopeful young person soared into so pleasing a cupid as to constitute the chief delight of the maternal part of the spectators. But in private, where his characteristics were a precocious cutaway coat and an extremely gruff voice, he became of the turf, turfy.
"By your leaves, gentlemen," said Mr. E. W. B. Childers, glancing round the room. "It was you, I believe, that were wishing to see Jupe."
"It was," said Mr. Gradgrind. "His daughter has gone to fetch him, but I can't wait. Therefore, if you please, I will leave a message for him with you."
"You see, my friend," Mr. Bounderby put in, "we are the kind of people who know the value of time, and you are the kind of people who don't know the value of time."
"I have not," retorted Mr. Childers, after surveying him from head to foot, "the honour of knowing you. But if you mean that you can make more money of your time than I can of mine, I should judge from your appearance that you are about right."
"And when you have made it, you can keep it too, I should think," said Cupid.
"Kidderminster, stow that," said Mr. Childers.
Master Kidderminster was Cupid's mortal name.
"What has he come cheeking his ear for, then?"
cried Master Kidderminster, showing a very irascible temperament.
"If you want to cheek us, pay your ochre at the doors and take it out."
"Kidderminster," said Mr. Childers, raising his voice, "stow that."
"Sir,"
to Mr. Gradgrind,
"I was addressing myself to you. You may or you may not be aware, for perhaps you've not been much in the audience, that Jupe has missed his tip very often lately.
What has he missed? Asked Mr. Gradgrind, glancing at the potent Bounderby for assistance.
Missed his tip. Offered at the Garters 4 times last night, and never done 'em once, said Master Kidderminster. Missed his tip at the Banners, too, and was loose in his ponging.
Didn't do what he ought to do. Was short in his leaps and bad in his tumbling, Mr. Childers interpreted.
Oh, said Mr. Gradgrind, that is tip, is it?
In a general way, that's missing his tip, Mr. E.W.B. Childers answered.
9 oils, merry legs, missing tips, garters, banners and ponging, eh?
Ejaculated Bounderby with his laugh of laughs.
Queer sort of company, too, for a man who was raised himself.
Lower yourself, then, retorted Cupid. Oh, Lord, if you've raised yourself so high as all that comes to, let yourself down a bit.
This is a very obtrusive lad, said Mr. Gradgrind, turning and knitting his brows on him.
We'd have had a young gentleman to meet you if we'd known you were coming,
retorted Master Kidderminster, nothing abashed.
It's a pity you don't have a bespeak, being so particular. You're on the tight, Jeff, ain't you?
What does this unmannerly boy mean? Asked Mr. Gradgrind, eyeing him in a sort of desperation.
By tight, Jeff. There, get out, get out, said Mr. Childers, thrusting his young friend from the room rather in the prairie manner.
Tight, Jeff, or slack, Jeff, it don't much signify. It's only tight rope and slack rope. You were going to give me a message for Jupe.
Yes, I was.
Then, continued Mr. Childers quickly, my opinion is he will never receive it. Do you know much of him?
I never saw the man in my life.
I doubt if you ever will see him now. It's pretty plain to me he's off.
Do you mean that he has deserted his daughter?
I mean, said Mr. Childers with a nod, that he has cut. He was goosed last night. He was goosed the night before last. He was goosed today. He has lately got in the way of being always goosed, and he can't stand it.
Why has he been so very much goosed? Asked Mr. Gradgrind, forcing the word out of himself with great solemnity and reluctance.
His joints are turning stiff, and he's getting used up, said Childers. He has his points as a cackler still, but he can't get a living out of them.
A cackler? Bounderby repeated. Here we go again.
A speaker, if the gentleman likes it better, said Mr. E.W.B. Childers,
superciliously throwing the interpretation over his shoulder and accompanying it with a shake of his long hair, which all shook at once.
Now it's a remarkable fact, sir, that it cut that man deeper to know that his daughter knew of his being goosed than to go through with it.
Good, interrupted Mr. Bounderby. This is good, Gradgrind. A man so fond of his daughter that he runs away from her. This is devilish good. Now, I'll tell you what, young man. I haven't always occupied my present station of life. I know what these things are. You may be astonished to hear it, but my mother ran away from me.
E.W.B. Childers replied pointedly that he was not at all astonished to hear it.
Very well, said Bounderby. I was born in a ditch, and my mother ran away from me. Do I excuse her for it? No. Have I ever excused her for it? Not I. What do I call her for it? I call her probably the very worst woman that ever lived in the world except my drunken grandmother. There's no family pride about me. There's no imaginative sentimental humbug about me. I call a spade, and I call the mother of Josiah Bounderby of Coketown without any fear or any favour what I should call her if she had been the mother of Dick Jones of Wapping. So with this man. He is a runaway rogue and a vagabond. That's what he is, in English.
It's all the same to me what he is or what he is not, whether in English or whether in French, retorted Mr. E.W.B. Childers, facing about. I'm telling your friend what's the fact. If you don't like to hear it, you can avail yourself of the open air. You give it mouth enough, you do, but give it mouth in your own building at least, remonstrated E.W.B. with stern irony. Don't give it mouth in this building till you're called upon. You have got some building of your own, I dare say, now.
Perhaps so, replied Mr. Bounderby, rattling his money and laughing.
Then give it mouth in your own building, will you, if you please. said Childers, because this isn't a strong building, and too much of you might bring it down.
Eyeing Mr. Bounderby from head to foot again, he turned from him as from a man finally disposed of to Mr. Gradgrind.
Jupe sent his daughter out on an errand not an hour ago, and then was seen to slip out himself with his hat over his eyes and a bundle tied up in a handkerchief under his arm. She will never believe it of him, but he has cut away and left her.
Pray, said Mr. Gradgrind,
why will she never believe it of him? Because those two were one, because they were never asunder. Because up to this time he seemed to doubt upon her, said Childers, taking a step or two to look into the empty trunk.
Both Mr. Childers and Master Kidderminster walked in a curious manner, with their legs wider apart than the general run of men, and with a very knowing assumption of being stiff in the knees. This walk was common to all the male members of Sleary's company, and was understood to express that they were always on horseback.
Poor Sissy. He'd better have apprenticed her, said Childers, giving his hair another shake as he looked up from the empty box. Now he leaves her without anything to take to.
It is creditable to you who have never been apprenticed to express that opinion, returned Mr. Gradgrind approvingly.
I never apprenticed. I was apprenticed when I was 7 years old.
Oh, indeed, said Mr. Gradgrind, rather resentfully, as having been defrauded of his good opinion. I was not aware of its being the custom to apprentice young persons to idleness, Mr. Bounderby put in with a loud laugh. No, by the Lord Harry, nor I.
Her father always had it in his head, resumed Childers, feigning unconsciousness of Mr. Bounderby's existence, that she was to be taught the deuce and all of education. How it got into his head, I can't say. I can only say that it never got out. He's been picking up a bit of reading for her here, and a bit of writing for her there, and a bit of ciphering for her somewhere else these 7 years.
Mr. E. W. B. Childers took one of his hands out of his pockets, stroked his face and chin, and looked with a good deal of doubt and a little hope at Mr. Gradgrind. From the first he had sought to conciliate that gentleman for the sake of the deserted girl.
When Sissy got into the school here, he pursued, her father was as pleased as Punch. I couldn't altogether make out why myself, as we were not stationary here, being but comers and goers anywhere. I suppose, however, he had this move in his mind. He was always half-cracked, and then considered her provided for. If you should happen to have looked in tonight for the purpose of telling him that you were going to do her any little service, said Mr. Childers, stroking his face again and repeating his look, it would be very fortunate and well-timed. Very fortunate and well-timed.
On the contrary, returned Mr. Gradgrind, I came to tell him that her connections made her not an object for the school, and that she must not attend any more.
Still, if her father really has left her, without any connivance on her part...
Bounderby, let me have a word with you. Upon this, Mr. Childers politely betook himself with his equestrian walk to the landing outside the door, and there stood stroking his face and softly whistling. While thus engaged, he overheard such phrases in Mr. Bounderby's voice as,
No! I say no! I advise you not! I say by no means!
While, from Mr. Gradgrind, he heard in his much lower tone the words,
But even as an example to Louisa of what this pursuit which has been the subject of a vulgar curiosity leads to and ends in. Think of it, Bounderby, in that point of view.
Meanwhile, the various members of Sleary's company gradually gathered together from the upper regions where they were quartered, and from standing about talking in low voices to one another and to Mr. Childers, gradually insinuated themselves and him into the room. There were two or three handsome young women among them, with their two or three husbands and their two or three mothers and their eight or nine little children, who did the fairy business when required. The father of one of the families was in the habit of balancing the father of another of the families on the top of a great pole. The father of a third family often made a pyramid of both those fathers, with Master Kidderminster for the apex and himself for the base. All the fathers could dance upon rolling casks, stand upon bottles, catch knives and balls, twirl hand basins, ride upon anything, jump over everything, and stick at nothing.
All the mothers could and did dance upon the slack wire and the tight rope, and perform rapid acts on bare-backed steeds. None of them were at all particular in respect of showing their legs, and one of them, alone in a Greek chariot, drove six in hand into every town they came to. They all assumed to be mighty rakish and knowing. They were not very tidy in their private dresses, they were not at all orderly in their domestic arrangements, and the combined literature of the whole company would have produced but a poor letter on any subject. Yet there was a remarkable gentleness and childishness about these people, a special inaptitude for any kind of sharp practice, and an untiring readiness to help and pity one another, deserving often of as much respect and always of as much generous construction as the everyday virtues of any class of people in the world. Last of all appeared Mr. Sleary, a stout man, as already mentioned, with one fixed eye and one loose eye, a voice, if it can be called so, like the efforts of a broken old pair of bellows, a flabby surface, and a muddled head which was never sober and never drunk.
"Squire," said Mr. Sleary, who was troubled with asthma and whose breath came far too thick and heavy for the letter S, "your servant. This is a bad piece of business, this is. You've heard of my clown and his dog being supposed to have morrised?"
He addressed Mr. Gradgrind, who answered, "Yes."
"Well, squire,"
he returned, taking off his hat and rubbing the lining with his pocket handkerchief, which he kept inside for the purpose,
"is it your intention to do anything for the poor girl, squire?"
"I shall have something to propose to her when she comes back," said Mr. Gradgrind.
"Glad to hear it, squire. Not that I want to get rid of the child any more than I want to stand in her way. I'm willing to take her apprentice, though at her age it's late. My voice is a little husky, squire, and not easy heard by them as don't know me. But if you'd been chilled and heated, heated and chilled and heated in the ring when you was young, as often as I have been, your voice wouldn't have lasted out, squire, no more than mine."
"I dare say not," said Mr. Gradgrind.
"What shall it be, squire, while you wait? Shall it be sherry? Give it a name, squire,"
said Mr. Sleary, with hospitable ease.
"Nothing for me, I thank you," said Mr. Gradgrind. "Don't say nothing, squire. What does your friend say? If you haven't took your feed yet, have a glass of bitters."
Here his daughter Josephine, a pretty, fair-haired girl of 18, who had been tied on a horse at 2 years old and had made a will at 12, which she always carried about with her, expressive of her dying desire to be drawn to the grave by the two piebald ponies, cried, "Father, hush, she has come back." Then came Sissy Jupe running into the room as she had run out of it. And when she saw them all assembled, and saw their looks, and saw no father there, she broke into a most deplorable cry, and took refuge on the bosom of the most accomplished tightrope lady, herself in the family way, who knelt down on the floor to nurse her and to weep over her.
"It's an internal shame, upon my soul it is," said Sleary.
"Oh, my dear father, my good, kind father, where are you gone? You are gone to try to do me some good, I know. You are gone away for my sake, I am sure. And how miserable and helpless you will be without me, poor, poor father, until you come back."
It was so pathetic to hear her saying many things of this kind, with her face turned upward and her arms stretched out as if she were trying to stop his departing shadow and embrace it, that no one spoke a word until Mr. Bounderby, growing impatient, took the case in hand.
"Now, good people all," said he, "this is wanton waste of time. Let the girl understand the fact. Let her take it from me, if you like, who have been run away from myself. Here, what's your name? Your father has absconded, deserted you, and you mustn't expect to see him again as long as you live."
They cared so little for plain fact, these people, and were in that advanced state of degeneracy on the subject, that instead of being impressed by the speaker's strong common sense, they took it in extraordinary dudgeon. The men muttered shame, and the women brute, and Sleary, in some haste, communicated the following hint apart to Mr. Bounderby.
"I tell you what, squire, to speak plain to you, my opinion is that you'd better cut it short and drop it. There are very good-natured people, my people, but they're accustomed to be quick in their movements, and if you don't act upon my advice, I'm damned if I don't believe they'll pitch you out of the window.
Mr. Bounderby being restrained by this mild suggestion, Mr. Gradgrind found an opening for his eminently practical exposition of the subject. "It is of no moment," said he, "whether this person is to be expected back at any time or the contrary. He has gone away, and there is no present expectation of his return. That, I believe, is agreed on all hands."
"That's agreed, Squire. Stick to that," from Sleary.
"Well, then, I, who came here to inform the father of the poor girl, Jupe, that she could not be received at the school any more, in consequence of there being practical objections, into which I need not enter, to the reception there of the children of persons so employed, am prepared in these altered circumstances to make a proposal. I am willing to take charge of you, Jupe, and to educate you and provide for you. The only condition, over and above your good behaviour, I make, is that you decide now, at once, whether to accompany me or remain here. Also, that if you accompany me now, it is understood that you communicate no more with any of your friends who are here present. These observations comprise the whole of the case."
"At the same time," said Sleary, "I must put in my word, Squire, so that both sides of the banner may be equally seen. If you like Cecilia to be prenticed, you know the nature of the work, and you know your companions. Emma Gordon, in whose lap you're a lion at present, would be a mother to you, and Josephine would be a sister to you. I don't pretend to be of the angel breed myself, and I don't say but what when you missed your tip you'd find me cut up rough and swear an oath or two at you. But what I say, Squire, is that good-tempered or bad-tempered, I never did a horse an injury yet, no more than swearing at him went, and that I don't expect I shall begin otherwise at my time of life with a rider. I never was much of a cackler, Squire, and I've said my say."
The latter part of this speech was addressed to Mr. Gradgrind, who received it with a grave inclination of his head, and then remarked, "The only observation I will make to you, Jupe, in the way of influencing your decision, is that it is highly desirable to have a sound practical education, and that even your father himself, from what I understand, appears on your behalf to have known and felt that much." The last words had a visible effect upon her. She stopped in her wild crying, a little detached herself from Emma Gordon, and turned her face full upon her patron. The whole company perceived the force of the change, and drew a long breath together that plainly said, "She will go." "Be sure you know your own mind, Jupe," Mr. Gradgrind cautioned her. "I say no more. Be sure you know your own mind."
"When Father comes back," cried the girl,
bursting into tears again after a minute's silence,
"how will he ever find me if I go away?"
"You may be quite at ease," said Mr. Gradgrind calmly. He worked out the whole matter like a sum. "You may be quite at ease, Jupe, on that score. In such a case, your father, I apprehend, must find out Mr. Sleary.
That's my name, Squire, not ashamed of it, known all over England and always pays his way.
Must find out Mr. Sleary, who would then let him know where you went. I should have no power of keeping you against his wish, and he would have no difficulty at any time in finding Mr. Thomas Gradgrind of Coketown. I am well known."
"Well known," assented Mr. Sleary, rolling his loose eye. "You're one of the sort, Squire, that keeps a precious sight of money out of the house. But never mind that at present."
There was another silence, and then she exclaimed, sobbing with her hands before her face,
"Oh, give me my clothes, give me my clothes, and let me go away before I break my heart."
The women sadly bestirred themselves to get the clothes together. It was soon done, for they were not many, and to pack them in a basket which had often travelled with them. Sissy sat all the time upon the ground, still sobbing and covering her eyes. Mr. Gradgrind and his friend Bounderby stood near the door, ready to take her away. Mr. Sleary stood in the middle of the room with the male members of the company about him, exactly as he would have stood in the centre of the ring during his daughter Josephine's performance. He wanted nothing but his whip. The basket packed in silence, they brought her bonnet to her and smoothed her disordered hair and put it on. Then they pressed about her and bent over her in very natural attitudes, kissing and embracing her, and brought the children to take leave of her, and were a tender-hearted, simple, foolish set of women altogether.
"Now, Jupe," said Mr. Gradgrind, "if you are quite determined, come."
But she had to take her farewell of the male part of the company yet, and every one of them had to unfold his arms, for they all assumed the professional attitude when they found themselves near Sleary, and give her a parting kiss. Master Kidderminster accepted, in whose young nature there was an original flavour of the misanthrope, who was also known to have harboured matrimonial views, and who moodily withdrew. Mr. Sleary was reserved until the last. Opening his arms wide, he took her by both her hands, and would have sprung her up and down, after the riding-master manner of congratulating young ladies on their dismounting from a rapid act. But there was no rebound in Sissy, and she stood, and she only stood before him, crying.
"Goodbye, my dear," said Sleary. "You'll make your fortune, I hope, and none of our poor folks will ever trouble you, I'll pound it. I wish your father hadn't taken his dog with him. It's an ill convenience to have the dog out of the bills. But on second thoughts, he wouldn't have performed without its master, so it's as broad as it's long."
With that, he regarded her attentively with his fixed eye, surveyed his company with his loose one, kissed her, shook his head, and handed her to Mr. Gradgrind as to a horse.
"There she is, Squire," he said, sweeping her with a professional glance, as if she were being adjusted in her seat. "And she'll do you justice. Goodbye, Cecilia."
"Goodbye, Cecilia."
"Goodbye, Sissy."
"God bless you, dear,"
in a variety of voices from all the room. But the riding master eye had observed the bottle of the nine oils in her bosom, and he now interposed with,
"Leave the bottle, my dear. It's large to carry. It will be of no use to you now. Give it to me."
"No, no," she said in another burst of tears. "Oh, no. Pray let me keep it for father till he comes back. He'll want it when he comes back. He had never thought of going away when he sent me for it. I must keep it for him, if you please."
"So be it, my dear. You see how it is, Squire. Farewell, Cecilia. My last words to you is this. Stick to the terms of your engagement, be obedient to the Squire, and forget us. But if, when you're grown up and married and well off, you come upon any horse riding ever, don't be hard upon it. Don't be cross with it. Give it a bespeak if you can, and think you might do worse. People must be amused, Squire, somehow," continued Sleary, rendered more pursy than ever by so much talking. "They can't be always a-working, nor yet they can't be always a-learning. Make the best of us, not the worst. I've got my living out of the horse riding all my life, I know. But I consider that I lay down the philosophy of the subject when I say to you, Squire, make the best of us, not the worst."
The Sleary philosophy was propounded as they went downstairs, and the fixed eye of philosophy, and its rolling eye too, soon lost the three figures and the basket in the darkness of the street. Chapter 7. Mrs. Sparsit. Mr. Bounderby being a bachelor, an elderly lady presided over his establishment in consideration of a certain annual stipend. Mrs. Sparsit was this lady's name, and she was a prominent figure in attendance on Mr. Bounderby's car as it rolled along in triumph with the bully of humility inside. For Mrs. Sparsit had not only seen different days, but was highly connected. She had a great aunt living in these very times called Lady Scadgers. Mr. Sparsit, deceased, of whom she was the relict, had been by the mother's side what Mrs. Sparsit still called a Powler. Strangers of limited information and dull apprehension were sometimes observed not to know what a Powler was, and even to appear uncertain whether it might be a business or a political party or a profession of faith.
The better class of minds, however, did not need to be informed that the Paulos were an ancient stock who could trace themselves so exceedingly far back that it was not surprising if they sometimes lost themselves, which they had rather frequently done, as respected horseflesh, blind hooky, Hebrew monetary transactions, and the insolvent debtor's court. The late Mr. Sparsit, being by the mother's side a Paula, married this lady, being by the father's side a Scadgers. Lady Scadgers, an immensely fat old woman with an inordinate appetite for butcher's meat and a mysterious leg which had now refused to get out of bed for 14 years, contrived the marriage at a period when Sparsit was just of age and chiefly noticeable for a slender body, weakly supported on 2 long slim props and surmounted by no head worth mentioning. He inherited a fair fortune from his uncle, but owed it all before he came into it, and spent it twice over immediately afterwards. Thus, when he died at 24, the scene of his decease, Calais, and the cause, Brandy, he did not leave his widow, from whom he had been separated soon after the honeymoon, in affluent circumstances. That bereaved lady, 15 years older than he, fell presently at deadly feud with her only relative, Lady Scadgers, and, partly to spite her ladyship, and partly to maintain herself, went out at a salary. And here she was now, in her elderly days, with the Coriolanian style of nose and the dense black eyebrows which had captivated Sparsit, making Mr. Bounderby's tea as he took his breakfast. If Bounderby had been a conqueror, and Mrs. Sparsit a captive princess whom he took about as a feature in his state processions, he could not have made a greater flourish with her than he habitually did. Just as it belonged to his boastfulness to depreciate his own extraction, so it belonged to it to exalt Mrs. Sparsit's. In the measure that he would not allow his own youth to have been attended by a single favourable circumstance, he brightened Mrs. Sparsit's juvenile career with every possible advantage, and showered wagon loads of early roses all over that lady's path. "And yet, sir," he would say, "how does it turn out after all? Why, here she is at 100 a year, I give her 100, which she is pleased to term handsome, keeping the house of Josiah Bounderby of Coketown." Nay, he made this foil of his so very widely known that third parties took it up, and handled it on some occasions with considerable briskness. It was one of the most exasperating attributes of Bounderby that he not only sang his own praises, but stimulated other men to sing them. There was a moral infection of claptrap in him. Strangers, modest enough elsewhere, started up at dinners in Coketown and boasted in quite a rampant way of Bounderby. They made him out to be the Royal Arms, the Union Jack, Magna Carta, John Bull, Habeas Corpus, the Bill of Rights, an Englishman's house is his castle, church and state, and God Save the Queen, all put together. And as often, and it was very often, as an orator of this kind brought into his peroration, princes and lords may flourish or may fade, a breath can make them as a breath has made, it was, for certain, more or less understood among the company that he had heard of Mrs. Sparsit.
"Mr. Bounderby," said Mrs. Sparsit, "you are unusually slow, sir, with your breakfast this morning."
"Why, ma'am," he returned, "I am thinking about Tom Gradgrind's whim." Tom Gradgrind, for a bluff, independent manner of speaking, as if somebody were always endeavouring to bribe him with immense sums to say Thomas, and he wouldn't. "Tom Gradgrind's whim, ma'am, of bringing up the tumbling girl."
"The girl is now waiting to know," said Mrs. Sparsit, "whether she is to go straight to the school or up to the lodge."
"She must wait, ma'am," answered Bounderby, "till I know myself. We shall have Tom Gradgrind down here presently, I suppose. If he should wish her to remain here a day or two longer, of course she can, ma'am."
"Of course she can, if you wish it, Mr. Bounderby."
"I told him I would give her a shake down here last night, in order that he might sleep on it before he decided to let her have any association with Louisa."
"Indeed, Mr. Bounderby, very thoughtful of you."
Mrs. Sparsit's Coriolanian nose underwent a slight expansion of the nostrils, and her black eyebrows contracted as she took a sip of tea.
"It's tolerably clear to me," said Bounderby, "that the little puss can get small good out of such companionship."
Are you speaking of young Miss Gradgrind, Mr. Bounderby?
Yes, ma'am. I'm speaking of Louisa.
Your observation being limited to little puss, said Mrs. Sparsit, and there being two little girls in question, I did not know which might be indicated by that expression.
Louisa, repeated Mr. Bounderby. Louisa, Louisa.
You are quite another father to Louisa, sir.
Mrs. Sparsit took a little more tea, and as she bent her again contracted eyebrows over her steaming cup, rather looked as if her classical countenance were invoking the infernal gods.
If you had said I was another father to Tom, young Tom, I mean, not my friend, Tom Gradgrind, you might have been nearer the mark. I'm going to take young Tom into my office. I'm going to have him under my wing, ma'am.
Indeed. Rather young for that, is he not, sir?
Mrs. Sparsit's sir, in addressing Mr. Bounderby, was a word of ceremony, rather exacting consideration for herself in the use than honouring him.
I'm not going to take him at once. He is to finish his educational cramming before then, said Bounderby. By the Lord Harry, he'll have enough of it first and last. He'd open his eyes, that boy would, if he knew how empty of learning my young Maw was at his time of life. Which, by the by, he probably did know, for he had heard of it often enough. But it's extraordinary the difficulty I have on scores of such subjects in speaking to anyone on equal terms. Here, for example, I've been speaking to you this morning about tumblers. Why, what do you know about tumblers? At the time when to have been a tumbler in the mud of the streets would have been a godsend to me, a prize in the lottery to me, you were at the Italian Opera. You were coming out of the Italian Opera, ma'am, in white satin and jewels, a blaze of splendour, when I hadn't a penny to buy a link to light you.
I certainly, sir, returned Mrs. Sparsit with a dignity serenely mournful, was familiar with the Italian Opera at a very early age.
"Egad, ma'am, so was I," said Bounderby, "with the wrong side of it. A hard bed the pavement of its arcade used to make, I assure you. People like you, ma'am, accustomed from infancy to lie on down feathers, have no idea how hard a paving stone is without trying it. No, no, it's of no use my talking to you about tumblers. I should speak of foreign dancers and of the West End of London, and Mayfair, and lords and ladies and honourables."
"I trust, sir," rejoined Mrs. Sparsit with decent resignation, "it is not necessary that you should do anything of that kind. I hope I have learnt how to accommodate myself to the changes of life. If I have acquired an interest in hearing of your instructive experiences, and can scarcely hear enough of them, I claim no merit for that, since I believe it is a general sentiment."
"Well, ma'am," said her patron, "perhaps some people may be pleased to say that they do like to hear in his own unpolished way what Josiah Bounderby of Coketown has gone through. But you must confess that you were born in the lap of luxury yourself. Come, ma'am, you know you were born in the lap of luxury."
"I do not, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit with a shake of her head, "deny it."
Mr. Bounderby was obliged to get up from table and stand with his back to the fire, looking at her. She was such an enhancement of his position.
"And you are in crack society, devilish high society," he said, warming his legs.
"It is true, sir,"
returned Mrs. Sparsit, with an affectation of humility the very opposite of his, and therefore in no danger of jostling it.
"You were in the tip-top fashion and all the rest of it," said Mr. Bounderby.
"Yes, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit, with a kind of social widowhood upon her. "It is unquestionably true."
Mr. Bounderby, bending himself at the knees, literally embraced his legs in his great satisfaction, and laughed aloud. Mr. and Miss Gradgrind being then announced, he received the former with a shake of the hand, and the latter with a kiss.
"Can Jupe be sent here, Bounderby?"
asked Mr. Gradgrind.
"Certainly." So Jupe was sent there.
On coming in, she curtsied to Mr. Bounderby and to his friend Tom Gradgrind, and also to Louisa, but in her confusion unluckily omitted Mrs. Sparsit. Observing this, the blustrous Bounderby had the following remarks to make.
"Now I tell you what, my girl, the name of that lady by the teapot is Mrs. Sparsit. That lady acts as mistress of this house, and she is a highly connected lady. Consequently, if ever you come again into any room in this house, you will make a short stay in it if you don't behave towards that lady in your most respectful manner. Now, I don't care a button what you do to me, because I don't affect to be anybody. So far from having high connections, I have no connections at all, and I come of the scum of the earth. But towards that lady, I do care what you do, and you shall do what is deferential and respectful, or you shall not come here.
I hope, Bounderby, said Mr. Gradgrind in a conciliatory voice, that this was merely an oversight.
My friend Tom Gradgrind suggests, Mrs. Sparsit, said Bounderby, that this was merely an oversight.
Very likely. However, as you are aware, mum, I don't allow of even oversights towards you.
You are very good indeed, sir, returned Mrs. Sparsit, shaking her head with her state humility. It is not worth speaking of.
Sissy, who all this time had been faintly excusing herself with tears in her eyes, was now waved over by the master of the house to Mr. Gradgrind. She stood looking intently at him, and Louisa stood coldly by with her eyes upon the ground, while he proceeded thus.
Jupe, I have made up my mind to take you into my house, and when you are not in attendance at the school, to employ you about Mrs. Gradgrind, who is rather an invalid. I have explained to Miss Louisa, this is Miss Louisa, the miserable but natural end of your late career, and you are to expressly understand that the whole of that subject is past and is not to be referred to any more. From this time you begin your history. You are at present ignorant, I know.
Yes, sir, very, she answered, curtsying.
I shall have the satisfaction of causing you to be strictly educated, and you will be a living proof to all who come into communication with you of the advantages of the training you will receive. You will be reclaimed and formed.
You have been in the habit now of reading to your father and those people I found you among, I dare say, said Mr. Gradgrind, beckoning her nearer to him before he said so and dropping his voice.
Only to father and Merrylegs, sir. At least I mean to father, when Merrylegs was always there.
"Never mind Merrylegs, Jupe," said Mr. Gradgrind with a passing frown. "I don't ask about him. I understand you to have been in the habit of reading to your father."
"Oh, yes, sir, thousands of times. They were the happiest, oh, of all the happy times we had together, sir."
It was only now, when her sorrow broke out, that Louisa looked at her.
"And what?"
asked Mr. Gradgrind in a still lower voice. "Did you read to your father, Jupe?"
"About the fairies, sir, and the dwarf, and the hunchback, and the genies,"
she sobbed out.
And about..."
"Hush," said Mr. Gradgrind, "that is enough. Never breathe a word of such destructive nonsense any more. Bounderby, this is a case for rigid training, and I shall observe it with interest."
"Well," returned Mr. Bounderby, "I have given you my opinion already, and I shouldn't do as you do. But very well, very well. Since you are bent upon it, very well."
So Mr. Gradgrind and his daughter took Cecilia Jupe off with them to Stone Lodge, and on the way Louisa never spoke one word, good or bad, and Mr. Bounderby went about his daily pursuits, and Mrs. Sparsit got behind her eyebrows and meditated in the gloom of that retreat all the evening.
Chapter 8. Never Wonder. Let us strike the keynote again, before pursuing the tune. When she was half a dozen years younger, Louisa had been overheard to begin a conversation with her brother one day by saying, "Tom, I wonder..." Upon which Mr. Gradgrind, who was the person overhearing, stepped forth into the light and said, "Louisa, never wonder." Herein lay the spring of the mechanical art and mystery of educating the reason without stooping to the cultivation of the sentiments and affections. Never wonder. By means of addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, settle everything somehow, and never wonder. "Bring to me," says Machocum Child, "yonder baby just able to walk, and I will engage that it shall never wonder."
Now, besides very many babies just able to walk, there happened to be in Coketown a considerable population of babies who had been walking against time towards the infinite world 20, 30, 40, 50 years and more. These portentous infants being alarming creatures to stalk about in any human society, the 18 denominations incessantly scratched one another's faces and pulled one another's hair by way of agreeing on the steps to be taken for their improvement, which they never did, a surprising circumstance when the happy adaptation of the means to the end is considered. Still, although they differed in every other particular, conceivable and inconceivable, especially inconceivable, they were pretty well united on the point that these unlucky infants were never to wonder. Body number one said they must take everything on trust. Body number two said they must take everything on political economy. Body number three wrote leaden little books for them, showing how the good grown-up baby invariably got to the savings bank and the bad grown-up baby invariably got transported. Body number four, under dreary pretenses of being droll, when it was very melancholy indeed, made the shallowest pretenses of concealing pitfalls of knowledge into which it was the duty of these babies to be smuggled and inveigled. But all the bodies agreed that they were never to wonder. There was a library in Coketown to which general access was easy. Mr. Gradgrind greatly tormented his mind about what the people read in this library, a point whereon little rivers of tabular statements periodically flowed into the howling ocean of tabular statements, which no diver ever got into any depth in and came up sane. It was a disheartening circumstance, but a melancholy fact that even these readers persisted in wondering. They wondered about human nature, human passions, human hopes and fears, the struggles, triumphs and defeats, the cares and joys and sorrows, the lives and deaths of common men and women. They sometimes, after 15 hours' work, sat down to read mere fables about men and women more or less like themselves, and about children more or less like their own. They took Defoe to their bosoms instead of Euclid, and seemed to be on the whole more comforted by Goldsmith than by Cocker. Mr. Gradgrind was forever working in print and out of print at this eccentric sum, and he could never make out how it yielded this unaccountable product. "I'm sick of my life, Lou. I hate it altogether, and I hate everybody except you," said the unnatural young Thomas Gradgrind in the hair-cutting chamber at twilight. "You don't hate Sissy, Tom. I hate to be obliged to call her Jupe, and she hates me," said Tom moodily. "No, she does not, Tom, I'm sure." "She must," said Tom. "She must just hate and detest the whole set out of us. They'll bother her head off, I think, before they have done with her. Already she's getting as pale as wax and as heavy as I am." Young Thomas expressed these sentiments, sitting astride of a chair before the fire, with his arms on the back and his sulky face on his arms. His sister sat in the darker corner by the fireside, now looking at him, now looking at the bright sparks as they dropped upon the hearth. "As to me," said Tom, tumbling his hair all manner of ways with his sulky hands, "I am a donkey, that's what I am. I am as obstinate as one. I am more stupid than one. I get as much pleasure as one, and I should like to kick like one." "Not me, I hope, Tom." "No, Lou, I wouldn't hurt you. I made an exception of you at first. I don't know what this jolly old jaundiced jail..." Tom had paused to find a sufficiently complimentary and expressive name for the parental roof, and seemed to relieve his mind for a moment by the strong alliteration of this one. "Would be without you." "Indeed, Tom. Do you really and truly say so?" "Why, of course I do. What's the use of talking about it?" returned Tom, chafing his face on his coat sleeve as if to mortify his flesh and have it in unison with his spirit. "Because, Tom," said his sister, after silently watching the sparks a while, "as I get older and nearer growing up, I often sit wondering here and think how unfortunate it is for me that I can't reconcile you to home better than I am able to do. I don't know what other girls know. I can't play to you or sing to you. I can't talk to you so as to lighten your mind, for I never see any amusing sights or read any amusing books that it would be a pleasure or relief to you to talk about when you are tired.
Well, no more do I. I'm as bad as you in that respect, and I am amused.